So tonight, I have a purposely vague and ambiguous title, just so that people wouldn't have too many preconceived notions when showing up. But two great human longings, lost and found. And instead of giving you an introduction, I'm just going to start by reading a couple of extended quotes, which gets us into the type of thing that I want to talk about tonight, or at least sort of kicks it off. The first is a quote from, or several quotes pieced together from G.K. Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy. And this is right near the very beginning of the book. He's explaining his reason for writing the book and what the book is about. I have often had a fancy for writing a romance about an English yachtsman who slightly miscalculated his course and discovered England under the impression that it was a new island in the South Seas. I always find, however, that I'm either too busy or too lazy to write this fine work, so I may as well give it away for the purpose of philosophical illustration. There will probably be a general impression that the man who landed, armed to the teeth and talking by signs, to plant the British flag on that barbaric temple, which turned out to be the pavilion at Brighton, felt rather a fool. I'm not here concerned to deny that he looked a fool, but if you imagine that he felt a fool, or at any rate that the sense of folly was his sole or his dominant emotion, then you have not studied with sufficient delicacy the rich romantic nature of the hero of this tale. His mistake was really a rather enviable mistake, and he knew it, if he was the man I take him for. What could be more delightful than to have in the same few minutes all the fascinating terrors of going abroad combined with all the humane security of coming home again? What could be better than to have all the fun of discovering South Africa without the disgusting necessity of landing there? What could be more glorious than to brace oneself up to discover New South Wales and then realize with a gush of happy tears that it was really Old South Wales? This at least seems to be the main problem for the philosophers, and is in a manner the main problem of this book. How can we contrive to be at once astonished at the world and yet at home in it? How can this queer cosmic town, with its many-legged citizens, with its monstrous and ancient lamps, how can this world give us at once the fascination of a strange town and the comfort and honor of being our own town? To show that a faith or a philosophy is true from every standpoint would be too big an undertaking, even for a much larger book than this. It is necessary to follow one path of argument, and this is the path that I here propose to follow. I wish to set forth my faith as particularly answering this double spiritual need, the need for that mixture of the familiar and the unfamiliar, which Christendom has rightly named romance. Skipping ahead a little bit. But nearly all people I have ever met in this Western society in which I live would agree to the general proposition that we need this life of practical romance, the combination of something that is strange with something that is secure. We need so to view the world as to combine an idea of wonder and an idea of welcome. We need to be happy in this wonderland without once being merely comfortable. It is this achievement of my creed that I shall chiefly pursue in these pages. Okay, that's G.K. Chesterton. Now, a little bit of a change of pace, we're going to read some more quotes from The Hobbit. I may just keep reading and forget about my lecture because it would be significantly more fun and interesting. But this is near the very beginning of The Hobbit. It's interesting that these similar reflections happen at the very beginning of stories. This hobbit was a very well-to-do hobbit, and his name was Baggins. The Bagginses had lived in the neighborhood of the hill for time out of mind, and people considered them very respectable, not only because most of them were rich, but also because they never had any adventures or did anything unexpected. You could tell what a Baggins would say on any question without the bother of asking him. This is a story of how a Baggins had an adventure and found himself doing and saying things altogether unexpected. He may have lost the neighbor's respect, but he gained... Well, you will see whether he gained anything in the end. I'm skipping ahead. Now you know enough to go on with. As I was saying, the mother of this hobbit, of Bilbo Baggins, that is, was the famous Belladonna Took, one of the three remarkable daughters of the old Took, head of the hobbits who lived across the water, the small river that ran at the foot of the hill. It had always been said that long ago, one or the other of the Tooks had married into a fairy family, the less friendly had said a goblin family. Certainly, there was still something not entirely hobbit-like about them, and once in a while, members of the Took clan would go and have adventures. They discreetly disappeared, and the family hushed it up. But the fact remained that the Tooks were not as respectable as the Bagginses, though they were undoubtedly richer. Still, it is probable that Bilbo, her only son, although he looked and behaved exactly like a second edition of his solid and comfortable father, got something a bit queer in his makeup from the Took side. Something that only waited for a chance to come out. The chance never arrived until Bilbo Baggins was grown up, being about 50 years old or so, and living in the beautiful hobbit hole built by his father, which I have just described for you, until he had, in fact, apparently, settled down immovably. And one last short paragraph. This takes place later after the dwarves have come to his house and they've just sung this song about searching after their hidden gold that was stolen. And the song starts to work on Bilbo Baggins as he sits by the fire. As they sang, the hobbit felt the love of beautiful things made by hands and by cunning and by magic moving through him. A fierce and a jealous love, the desire of the hearts of dwarves. Then something Tookish woke up inside him, and he wished to go and see the great mountains, and hear the pine trees, and the waterfalls, and explore the caves, and wear a sword instead of a walking stick. He looked out of the window. The stars were out in a dark sky above the trees. He thought of the jewels of the dwarves shining in dark caverns. Suddenly in the wood beyond the water, a flame leapt up, probably somebody lighting a wood fire, and he thought of plundering dragons settling on his quiet hill and kindling it all to flames. He shuddered, and very quickly he was playing Mr. Baggins of Bag End Underhill again. Okay. Much later, when he is far, far, far from home, he says this, "And I'm sure the rain has gotten into the dry clothes and into the food bags," thought Bilbo. "Bother burgling and everything to do with it. I wish I was at home in my nice hole by the fire with the kettle just beginning to sing." It was not the last time that he wished that. So, you may have begun to anticipate the two kinds of longings that I'm talking about here based on what I've quoted to you already. There are... Actually, I should have had that picture up while I was reading the story from The Hobbit. Sorry. These two quotes, or these two series of quotes, have something in common, I think, that people, as well as hobbits, tend to have two deep desires, or at least this particular hobbit. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a heads up in terms of our outline for tonight. I want to talk a little bit about these two longings that we've been reflecting on, and then think a little bit about what it means that our longings get misdirected, what might it mean that they could get redirected, and then reflect a bit on whether there's an apologetic of longing. Hopefully that will become clear what I mean by all those things later on. But these two desires that many people seem to have, that Chesterton is referring to, on the one hand there's the desire for adventure, to explore, to experience newness, to be in the presence of something wild and unexpected. In Chesterton's words, it's to be astonished, this longing to be astonished. He even calls it a human need. On the other hand, there's a different desire, which is the desire to come home, to find security, to be known, to find familiar things, to lay your pack down at the door, so to speak, and let your guard down to hear your name spoken with recognition. I was going to play that song from the TV show Cheers. Sometimes you want to go where everyone knows your name, but most of the song is really terrible, so I decided not to play it. But there's something of that human longing too, the desire to come home and be known and to be around things and people that you know. You can see that these two desires pull in different directions, to experience both surprise and comfort, to experience adventure and security, newness and sameness, to set out and to come back, to meet new people and yet to know and be known by people. These seem to be pulling us in different directions, in opposite directions, in fact. On paper, these seem to be almost contradictory desires. So longings that if I pursue them, any one of them, I'll lead in a different direction than the other. Will lead to a different way of life, different kind of living. And it seems almost unreasonable to expect of life that I could be fulfilled in both ways, right? In both of these longings. To satisfy a need for exploration and yet to feel at home, right? Are we expecting the impossible? I don't know. In reality, I think most of us feel the pull of both in some way or another. And I don't want to speak for anybody, but I sense that probably many of us know that there's something good about both. I'll explain a little bit about what I mean here. When we say, imagine you've been traveling for a couple of weeks on end, and most of you who do this, if you have a home that you love, you start to miss it. So much that you experience it as a kind of sickness. We call it homesickness. It's a pain in your gut. a longing for a place that's familiar and loved. So people that have moved all over the place or have spent many years growing up, maybe just moving because of their parents' work, jobs, or whatever, often grow up to feel rootless. And it's not a good feeling, even though it may be all that someone knows. But to know that nothing is pinning you down and there's no place you feel bound to or that recognizes you. So there's something not right about this. Having a home and being known and having roots are all good things. So we can say that the longing for home is a good thing, I think. And yet, many of us also have experienced times when we felt so choked and stifled and unchallenged and restless and bored and too safe. Maybe we've been dysfunctionally bound to our home in some way. And we know that to surrender to total apathy and not do anything would really be wrong somehow. It would be to fall short of some real potential that we have. And really what we should do is get up and head out and do something hard even. Incidentally, we've been joking about this in our workers' meetings recently. We've been posting our lectures that we record on a podcast, and then it's made available for people to listen to. And you can go onto one of the little monitor pages and see how many times each lecture is downloaded. And Mary Frances, my coworker, has beaten us all by like about 1,000 downloads on her lecture. It's moving on and moving out, right?
Why we need to run away from home.
Why we need to run away from home, okay. Anyway, interesting that this particular topic was of such significance to people that I mean, not that our other lectures are boring necessarily, but it obviously strikes a chord. With people. So, in these kinds of situations when we feel that we could just give up and surrender to our apathy and not do much of anything and whatever it happens to be, you know, if you're still living with your parents or whatever, it's not just that scenario, but in these kinds of situations we use the term the comfort zone almost exclusively in a negative way, right? We say it's something you need to move beyond or break out of. It's something that's good for you and maybe matures you and strengthens you to step out of that place of comfort. And so we can also say that the longing to set out and accomplish something for yourself is also a good thing. So both of these seemingly contradictory desires, I think, are right and good. And I want to explore how is that? How can that be? We hope that somehow they do not have to be mutually exclusive. that we can have our cake and eat it too, as the expression goes. Somehow find the fulfillment of our longings for both adventure and for home. Okay. So, these two longings, I think, are very, very deep and basic to being human. And as we can see, I think they manifest themselves in very different and very practical ways. That's not to say that we pursue these longings in straightforward or healthy ways, necessarily. Most people are a bundle of confused longings. Most of us experience strong desires, but we sort of wander through life without being able to name a particular object of those longings. That's the case for many people. We feel strong desires for different things at different times in life, but we're not really sure if there's a proper object that's really there, or a consistent object for that desire. So the many ways in which we see these two deep desires functioning, but in a misdirected way. So I'm really actually still back here. And this is, I think, misdirected towards objects that might appear to promise fulfillment, but really do not very much. That actually, as we live them out, cause havoc and destruction for us. And so, one ways in which these two desires could be misdirected is that they're totally out of proportion. And this is actually the slide I wanted to show you. Chesterton describes both these longings as good, mutually coexisting in the same person without canceling each other out. This longing to be astonished and to yet feel at home in the world. And yet we see people, many people, including ourselves sometimes, that tend to favor one over the other so strongly. And so there's this whole idea of the thrill seeker and the homebody, these two extreme polar opposites, or the claustrophobic or the agoraphobic. Not necessarily literally claustrophobic and agoraphobic, but that idea, the person who can't stand to be shut in and the person that can't stand to not be shut in. And is actually petrified of being out in large spaces, in open spaces, as opposed to the claustrophobic who's petrified of being shut in small places. And so this is, I'm speaking of this metaphorically, not clinically. Most of us know people who can never settle down, I think, who have moved from one novel experience to the next, but they're restless. And as a result, they have a hard time developing close relationships or finding community. And even if they long for these good things in some way, the longing to keep moving outweighs it. So settling down and finding a home feels more stifling than comforting. This is the claustrophobic attitude towards life. But then there's people who never set out at all. I'm talking at extremes here. I'm not. These are generalizations. I'm talking about extremes. There's probably something of both in most of us. But people who are so attached to home, to comfort, to security, that they never really step out. They may be intimidated by the world outside, the people, the dangers, the risks, the potential of difficult commitments they might get into if they venture out, the potential of failure they might experience if they set out. And so these are sort of polar opposite ends of the spectrum, and we see different people whose temperaments kind of lead them towards one or the other pole. And again, somehow, some way, the desire for adventure and the desire for home should coexist. But when we see a strong imbalance in somebody, it's unhealthy, usually. And I'm just going to go on a very, very brief tangent that I'm not going to explore much at all. But in very often, particularly in Christian circles, these two poles are thought to correspond to the sexes, very often. So there's a lot of thinking about gender roles that has come out of this. Probably the most well-known book is Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. I think it's John Eldridge. Suggesting that the desire for adventure, for battle, to be wild and free, is intrinsically a male desire. And that women are intrinsically desire to be captivating and essentially to be rescued. I'm not going to get into this at all, although I am going to say in passing, just because I thought it was important to mention it, I think there's a lot of problems with this. These desires do not line up neatly along gender lines or male and female lines at all. And I think we run into trouble when we try to force men and women into particular categories in this way, because not everybody fits the category. So, another way in which these desires are misdirected, the first way I was talking about is sort of an imbalance. Another way is seeking fulfillment by pursuing things that are in themselves intrinsically bad. Things that end up being terribly destructive to ourselves and to others. This is really inadequate here. I'm just talking through very briefly, and I'm hoping to lecture for a short amount of time tonight so that we can have a discussion. But I wonder how often the longing for novelty, exploration, and excitement has led to marital infidelity. It causes people to forsake their husbands or their wives. The association of fidelity with boredom and staleness and being stifled. I think that probably happens a lot. It may not be the only cause of infidelity, but it's certainly an aspect of the imagination that gets captured by being unfaithful. I wonder how many pornography addictions start in this way, the promise of infinite sexual novelty, but leading to greater and greater boredom with wholesome sexual interactions. I wonder also, each one of these could be a whole series of lectures, so I'm just skipping along here. I wonder if our current obsession with virtual reality technology that's just making huge leaps and bounds today, everyone is talking about it and planning to buy the new headset or whatever, I wonder whether this obsession with virtual reality is a sign of our desire to fulfill our longings for both strangeness and security. So we're being promised the experiences or the impression of faraway, exotic experiences, adventures, from the comfort of our homes, even our couches, maybe. And the almost messianic language used to describe the new digital platform of virtual reality. It makes me wonder whether it's a sign of how important these two longings really are to us as humans, to experience newness and strangeness and adventure, and yet to be totally safe and secure. You don't have to go to the Grand Canyon anymore and hike down into the, river basin. You can do that from your living room. But even if the technology advances in leaps and bounds, which it surely will, will it be able to satisfy us in the depths of those two longings? Can it successfully stand in as an authentic object for human longing? Because longing is about desiring an object. It's always directed towards something, which is the object of that longing. We may not know exactly what the object is. We may be confused or muddled, but longings always have objects. And I think we've seen the same thing going on for many years, just generally on the internet or in social media. You can get online at any point you want, join some chat room or get on some social media platform and lambaste someone who you've never met, who you will never know, someone who will never know your real name necessarily, and who will never have an opportunity to confront you face to face for what you're saying. And that's just par for the course. That's this normal way of interacting for us today. All the thrills of a good middle school fight in the hallway, right? Without any risk at all. Without showing your face or getting off your couch. So I think the deep appeal of this kind of technology is a symptom of a deeper longing, perhaps. And I'm not going to talk any more about that, but that's another interesting avenue for discussion. Just for your information, Liz Snell, who's a worker with us here, is going to be lecturing on some of these very issues on June 30th, Talking to Ourselves, Solitude, Community, and Technology. So come on out on June 30th. This whole lecture is just an advertisement for other lectures. But what about this possibility of longings redirected? If both of these longings are good, and yet we see them misdirected towards false objects, the question is there a true object towards which these can be redirected, an object that won't destroy us for seeking it? Can we expect to find fulfillment of both desires? Or is the only solution to chase after one to the neglect of the other, and then chase after one and sort of fluctuate back and forth because they ultimately just contradict each other? Many sensible people would say that a healthy life depends on some sort of practical balance between these two. There's times when it's appropriate to set out and take risks. There's times when it's better to retreat and take stock, and that is very sensible. Practically speaking, as life goes, this is very true. The church, or the purpose of the church, as set out in the New Testament, I think is doing something very much like this. The church is not actually where we go to be ministered unto us only. The church is a place where believers are supposed to gather and be equipped to gather and worship the Lord, to be reoriented towards reality, to the truth. And then the rest of the week is when the church is supposed to set out and do ministry. Rather than having the church be a model of the pastor being the one who does ministry for the Christians in a professional role, and then the rest of the week is just normal life or whatever. I think a much more faithful picture of the church is this of sort of coming together, equipping each other, and then setting out to do ministry all the time, which is the responsibility of each one of us who belong to Christ. Anyway, what does the Bible have to say about these kinds of desires? There's a million things or directions you could go in, so I'm just going to speak kind of generally. The ultimate answer to our longings is not to be found in some healthy balance back and forth or fluctuating between two poles. The promise of the Bible is that these two seemingly conflicting longings are actually met in the one living God. This is something that Chesterton is getting at in his introduction to Orthodoxy. There actually is one object that, in the deepest possible sense, satisfies both our longings to be astonished and to be welcomed home. And the object is an infinite person. And those two words are both very, very important to what I'm trying to communicate. Infinite person. The Bible teaches that God, the creator of all things, is infinite and personal. And these are two concepts that don't really come together in any other context. They usually don't belong together. Infinite and personal. We can imagine some concept of infinity that is abstract and impersonal. Maybe it's mathematical. Or, on the other hand, we can imagine a person who is very limited and finite, like a friend. So you have someone who's a person, but not infinite, and then you have infinity, which is not a person. But really, only in the living God does infinity and personality come together. So he's the one who has always existed, who stands apart from the universe he made, and yet knows us and can speak to us. And he's described in the Bible as the friend and a helper to his people. Another way of saying this is that God is transcendent and immanent. These two words, Dick lectured last week and talked about this at much greater length. If you're interested in listening to that lecture, please go to our website and you can listen to the podcast. But he talks a lot about the transcendence of God and the immanence of God. Now, transcendent means that God is above and beyond his world in every way. He's uncontainable, uncontained and uncontainable. So he transcends the natural order, the physical things that we can see and touch and taste. But he's also immanent, which means right here, with us in this room, very close, aware of what is in each of our hearts, knowing us better than we know ourselves. Intimately involved in what's actually happening in his world, not distant. So he's both beyond the world and uncontained by it, and in the world and active in it. One of the wonderful reflections on this is in Psalm 8, and I'll try to leave this on the screen for a while because it relates to a lot of the other things I'm saying tonight. I'll just read it. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You've made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You've made them rulers over the works of your hands and put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And you see this, this amazing combination of God's transcendence and his immanence in verse 3 and 4 throughout the psalm, but particularly this sort of a focal point when you imagine the psalmist is under the stars. He's looking up at perhaps the Milky Way. There's a lot less light pollution back in his day than there is today. So there's no clouds, you could probably see the stars pretty well. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? It's a rhetorical question. He's wondering at the fact that he knows God does care for humankind, and that he is mindful. He even notices it all. It's astonishing to the psalmist, given that God made the stars and actually is sustaining them in every moment right now. This same God who's doing that bothers to even take note of me. And that's a statement of God's transcendence and his immanence. He's both utterly beyond his world that he's made, and he is right here with us in it. Which is really getting at what I was talking about before, as God as the infinite and yet personal God. So what's the significance of this? There's huge significance of this. I'll just talk about two big ideas that are very related to each other, but we were made to resemble this God who's infinite and personal, but we were also made for friendship with this God. And so these two things are quite connected. First of all, we were made to resemble him. I'm going to go back to Psalm 8 just so you can have it on the screen if you want. Adam and Eve were made in God's image, Genesis 1 tells us, and 2. Every person ever since, despite our sin and brokenness, is still an image bearer of the Lord. And this means a whole lot of things. The image of God has to do with a designation that's just given to us. If you're a human being, you are an image of God, regardless of how gifted and interesting you are. But it's also connected to many capacities that human beings had before the fall and have in a diminished way or a twisted way now after the fall. But still, a human being has certain capacities that are appropriate for the image of God. One of the many aspects of our image-bearing status is dominion. So at creation, people were given an authority. This is what dominion is. It's an authority in creation and over the rest of creation. We were God's representatives in the world, his image bearers, meaning the giving the world a small picture of what the Lord is like who made it. And Adam and Eve were placed in the garden to subdue, to work with it, to refine it, to tend it and to care for it. And there's this wonderful image of everything being good already, but with an openness to human input. Room for development. It wasn't a fixed and static kind of understanding of perfection, which is much more of a Greek understanding. It was a picture of perfection, which is much more dynamic and alive. So dominion was given to Adam and Eve, and another way of saying that is agency. It's a word that sometimes we use when we talk about dominion. Our choices actually matter and have an effect on the world around us. So we have the capacity to make meaningful and intentional changes. We don't just float passively and get acted upon. We're capable of acting upon the world around us. So this is how we were made, and yet because of the fall, we see dominion corrupted in really as many ways as there are people to corrupt it. And one of Dick's points last week was that dominion often becomes domination. So we have this ability as human beings to affect the world around us, but because we are broken and sinful, we very often use that ability to control and manipulate and dominate other people who are supposed to have the same dominion we are. But very often domination is a way of taking away someone else's dominion, which was God's gift to them and that we're never supposed to take away from them. All this is to say, the longing for adventure and exploration and newness and astonishment that we've been talking about, I think in some ways is the call of our own dominion. It's our own dominion calling to us. The desire that we each have, it may be deeply buried, it may be distorted in some way, but the desire that we each have to fulfill our creational purpose, to set out and do something, to walk into something unexpected and to learn, to explore, to test the world around us. These are very good creational gifts of God that are ways of exercising our dominion. When our dominion is taken away or suppressed in some way, we do not thrive. I think people become like ticking time bombs when their dominion is taken away. In all kinds of different ways, we do not thrive. One of a powerful picture of this is the movie Raging Bull, the Scorsese movie about the boxer. The whole film is about treating this person like he's an animal and putting him in a cage, letting him out of the cage to fight, and then putting him back in a cage, and it is a disaster of a life. There's carnage around him everywhere. His personal life is just a mess. And it's quite an amazing demonstration of what happens when you take away someone's dominion. Of course, the enslavement of other people is one of the most obvious and extreme forms of denying dominion to people. And understandably, people become like ticking time bombs when they're enslaved, because we're not supposed to have that dominion taken away from us. One of the other reasons, seemingly, that God made us in His image is so that we could relate to Him personally. Think of the purpose why God would have made other persons. Only a person can have a personal relationship with someone else. No offense to anybody who has a relationship with a pet, but there's a different thing when you have a relationship with a person who really can look at you and question you and talk to you and push back and know you. And while it is appropriate that we exercise our dominion by relating to the rest of creation, we relate to God differently. When we talk about a personal relationship with God, it's not one of dominion, per se, although God gives us an amazing authority to just talk to Him, actually. So maybe it is our dominion in a sense there. But when we look to God, it is as part of creation. We're totally dependent on Him in the same way that the rest of creation is. We are part of His creation. We are placed over that creation, but as we look to God, we're on the sort of the creation side of that gap, looking towards God, who is the infinite creator. And the appropriate response is to trust Him. This is one of Dick's main points in his lecture last week. You should go check it out. Dominion and trust are these two very, very crucial and foundational purposes of humanity. To have dominion in the world over creation, but then to trust the Lord who gave it to us. And so I think this is another aspect of what we were made for. We were made to know and trust our Maker, to view Him and Him alone as our provider, our refuge, our strength, our shepherd, our very real help in time of need. There is just an endless series of biblical images to help this point sink in for us. God is to be trusted. We need God, in the words of Psalm 23, to make us lie down in green pastures and lead us beside still waters. I had a professor in grad school who told us that still waters are the only kind of water a sheep can drink from without drowning. If you lead the sheep to drink in a fast-moving mountain stream, every so often one of them will just fall in and die. Still waters are where you want to lead your flock. So, in a fallen world that is at times completely inhospitable to our existence, the Bible encourages us to view God Himself as our home, even now. This is one of the amazing things that should give us confidence about being in Christ, that God ourself is our refuge and our rest. And so, the longing to come home, to be known, to feel safe and secure and be at ease, this is the call of our dependence. So just like our longing to sit out and experience newness and adventure is the call of our dominion, our longing to come home and be known and feel safe and secure is the call of our dependence. The desire that we have, again, and maybe deeply buried and distorted, but the desire that we have to simply accept that we have a loving home and to finally give up running away and trying to build shelters for ourselves in any number of other different ways. So we were made for this dominion and we were made for this trust. But we were also made for friendship with God, as I was saying earlier. Not yet, sorry. And I think we see the ultimate fulfillment of the two great longings as we grow in our capacity for friendship with God. Remember, the Lord is both infinite and personal, transcendent and imminent. It's in this relational sense that both our longings are met in the Christian faith, I believe. So, because God is the one who both inspires awe and welcomes intimacy, there's awe and intimacy to be found in knowing God. We are meant to both fear Him and be at home in His presence. Which means we have to have an understanding of what fearing the Lord is that isn't abject terror. It's something else. It's taking Him very, very seriously, but being at home in His presence. The fact that He is endless and without rival, I think, should inspire awe in us. It's the ultimate jarring experience of being in the presence of the other. It's not that God's transcendence is just an opportunity for us to have adventures. It's not a self-indulgent thing. Good thing God exists so I can always have adventures. But even so, to seek Him and to know Him is to come close to something that's unfathomable. We'll never come to the end of who He is. We'll grow in knowing Him for all eternity, even when we're with Him. There'll always be something more to learn. We can sit out again and again without the fear of becoming bored or stifled or hemmed in if we're actually relating to the real God who's there. He's the source of all life and all vitality and really everything interesting. No one who sees God in the Bible responds by yawning or saying, oh, here we go again. Experiences of the presence of the Lord are always terrifying but always, they always have an effect and a cause and something redemptive. But there's also the fact that He is Himself our home, our security, the image of a mother hen gathering the chicks under her wings is the image that we're given in the Old Testament. And this is the answer to our desire to come home. He is completely trustworthy. He does not just tolerate our presence. like some sort of stern or dysfunctional father might just tolerate our presence, but delights in us. This is the picture of what coming home is like. Maybe the most profound picture is the story of the prodigal son, as he comes back after deciding that he needs to apologize to his father and offer to be a servant in the father's household. It says when he was still a long way off, his father saw him and ran to him, which means the father's waiting and watching, and brushes aside the son's apology and commands the servants to prepare for the party. Jesus isn't just being fun by telling us this story. He's giving us a picture of the anticipation that his father has at getting us back, which to some of us might seem a little undignified for God, right? Running down the driveway, and you know, but oh well. It's what Jesus tells us is an accurate picture of his father. So, we were made for this kind of awe and this kind of intimacy. And I think it's only in God that we find both in the same place. Not in some delicate balance of one and then the other and one and then the other, but fear of God and friendship with God go hand in hand because of who he is. Now, there's a huge and a weighty paradox here, that these two desires can come together and meet, I think. And I think we see the paradox most vividly in the person of Jesus himself. Because Jesus himself is a deep mystery. He is the Lord of all creation, and he's also a man who you could touch. You could shake his hand. You could eat with him. In Matthew 8, when Jesus and his disciples are in the boat, and the wind picks up, and the waves get big, and the storm hits them, one minute Jesus, their friend, is asleep because he's frail and he's tired, and a whole day of preaching wipes him out, just like it would wipe out you and me. I've never preached for a whole day, thankfully, but I imagine it would wipe me out. And it wiped Jesus out. He's tired, and he's sleeping in the back of the boat. His disciples love him. You imagine that they're doing the work now as he rests because he's had an extremely taxing day. Maybe one of them covered him with a cloak or something like that in the back of the boat. The next minute, he wakes up and he talks to the weather. And the weather responds instantly to his voice. And the disciples are afraid in a deeper way than they were of the storm. And they're in the presence of someone they know and they love and they've eaten with. And these very practical, mundane, everyday sorts of things. And yet they know they're in the presence of you assume that the one who made the ocean and commands the water. There's rich imagery of Genesis in that passage. So even more so, I think, at Jesus' death. It's both Jesus, the man who was kind and wise, their friend, their rabbi, who rebuked them at times, their traveling companion for 3 years, who was unjustly tried by a corrupt court of men, and is being publicly shamed in his death. This is what the crucifixion is. But it's also God himself taking the full weight of human folly and sin upon his own shoulders. So in the life and death of Jesus, the seemingly distant theological realities that are way out there and the daily earthy human realities are always being glued together. They're happening at the same time in the person of Christ all the time. Jesus Christ is God's transcendence and immanence embodied. And he's no less God for being a man and no less man for being a God. Being God. I'm going to move on to my last section here about the apologetic of longing. And this is, I will confess, sort of half-baked. And so I'm interested in your response to it. And it's something that I want to continue to think about. And read about. Basically, what I mean here is by apologetic, I mean a defense for the faith. You know, apologetics is all about offering a word back to our culture that has essentially dismissed the existence of God and the reality of the Christian faith. How do we speak into that culture in a way that makes sense and isn't just easily dismissed again. In a provocative, in a challenging way, in a loving way. And cultural apologetics has a lot to do with understanding the culture we're in and that we ourselves are affected by. So an apologetic of longing, in what way can the fact that, because I believe people are made in the image of God and they have these longings deeply ingrained in them, in what way can that knowledge help me to direct people towards the object of those longings? So I want to say this. I'm not sure that I have a good argument for it, but I want to say this. All the longing we see in humans is an indication, first of all, that we were made. I think it is that, actually. I just don't think we can convince everybody to believe that. All the longings we see in humans are an indication that we were made. And more specifically, they're an indication of how and why we were made. I think this can be a potentially very fruitful conversation if we're interacting with people who are not Christians, to encourage them to think about their own longings. Where do they come from? How do you explain them? What's the point of them? What do you do with them? Are they meant to lead us towards anything in particular or not? Are they something we have in common with other people or not? Or are they just a personal thing? For many people, I think life is all about individually figuring out what your deepest desires and passions and goals are, and then just pursuing those with all the passion and strength you have, no matter what. And that's what it is to be authentic and true to yourself. And there's a million ways in which we're reminded of this, to follow our hearts, to be true to ourselves. If you listen to the radio for very long, you may be told that exactly, actually. This sounds great, but there's an enormous number of people who, even after pursuing their heart's desires, who have made personal happiness their priority, are completely dissatisfied and restless and disillusioned and empty. Not everybody, but this is something we do see. And this is not just the people who failed to achieve their own goals. This is very often the people who have achieved their own goals, the people who have actually succeeded in the ways they set out. Succeeded in every measurable way, maybe. You think of the stories of people making their fortune and then wondering, is this all there is? Is this what it was about? What am I missing here? So the question is, was there anything to these longings at all, or were they just a complete sham? Was the longing to explore and set out in life just self-indulgent and arrogant? Or was the longing to come home and be secure just weakness and overdependence on other people? Or were they true, although imperfect, but true indications that there is a worthy object of desire out there that would not have disappointed us? So if we've been chasing shadows of the real thing, what and where is the real thing? I think that's the question that we need to find better ways of asking. What is the longing beneath the longings? And I'm going to embarrass myself a little bit right now, because I the past few years have gotten very interested in fishing. And when I think about longing, usually something about fishing comes to mind, but it's not exactly true, but there's an image that I have in my mind as a metaphor. Let's see. We'll see if it works. So, who has actually been fishing in a boat before and actually caught something? Okay, yeah. All right. You don't have to love fishing. I hate sports analogies because I don't understand sports. So I apologize if you don't understand or hate fishing. You're in a boat fishing. Suddenly you feel this heavy, heavy tug on your line. You know it's a big fish because you've caught smaller fish before and you know what they feel like. You fight the fish. Okay, I'm just going to show you. I think I have a great... Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So you... Most of the images in my slideshow are of fishing, so... you fight the fish, you slowly reel it in, your rod is bent way over, right, and it's moving all over the place, and you can't see it, but you feel how big it is. And as it gets closer, the water starts to churn. So this is something, as you're about to get the fish up to the boat, the water starts to churn. It looks like it's boiling, kind of. The fish is still invisible, but the water starts to move. What if that was all? So that's the water moving. So what if that was all fishing was? What if the whole point of fishing was just to feel the tug of the rod and see the water moving, right? There was nothing more to it than that. Someone might be able to find something interesting about that. But it's hard to imagine that it would be, over time, very exciting. Because, of course, the only reason why the tug and the churning water are so exhilarating is because you know there's a real fish under the surface, right? There's something down there doing the tugging and the churning. The excitement of fighting a big fish, for most people, is the anticipation of seeing it and having it in your hand. And having it finally break the surface and show itself. So I picked a really cheesy picture of a kid with a huge catfish because, I mean, there's millions of pictures, but I thought, you know, he looks so happy. There's such a huge, ugly fish. But think of the excitement of that would have taken him a long, long time to reel in. Okay. I'm just going to meditate on that for a little while and all. So much of the pursuit of happiness in the people we see today is trying to be satisfied with the splashes on the surface of the water. They're exciting, but they're only indications of something deeper and more fundamental that we are longing for without knowing, but that we were made to find. So the proper and satisfying object of our deepest desires is like the huge fish under the surface. We may see its effects on the surface, but we will not be satisfied until we have it in hand. No one would go to the trouble of fishing if there was not something real under the water. If all the churning on top of the water didn't mean anything. And this is very much sort of what St. Augustine is getting at in the very beginning of the Confessions. It gets quoted a lot, I think, because it's on the first page of the Confessions. there's lots and lots of similar gems if you take the time to read. And a great lecture on the Confessions by Joshua Chestnut out there. But man is restless until he finds his rest in you, essentially. There's this restlessness in the hearts of human beings because we're meant to find rest in God, and we spend so much time trying to find rest in other things. And this is, again, something similar to what is said in the book of Ecclesiastes, the very beginning of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 3. He has set eternity in the human heart. That's a really good thing to reflect on. What does it mean that God sets eternity in the human heart? And all of the mundane, daily, sort of grinding, tedious things that we do, we have eternity in our hearts, which means we're always somehow desiring something bigger beyond, something more significant and grounding and with more meaning than whatever we happen to be doing right now. And I think this actually, the eternity in our hearts is the source of a redemptive discontent that we have. There's a discontent that we have when we are not seeking God. And it's a redemptive discontent. Maybe God places eternity in our hearts so that we would keep seeking after him and not be satisfied with smaller things, with the splashing on top of the water. So, a strictly naturalistic explanation of human life. If you're a materialist and you don't believe there is a God, everything that exists is right here and measurable. This kind of explanation of human life actually really offers no kind of satisfaction for these two great longings, offers no help in terms of what to do with our desires. Neither does it offer satisfying explanations, I think, for why people so often long for things that cannot possibly satisfy them. Why do we do that? Why do we chase after things that ultimately disappoint us again and again and again? Why would nature conspire to make us chase after so much disappointment? At the very least, it seems intentionally mean. what could suggest... many have... I'm not well read in this subject, but I know that many people have written on this and related issues, basically explaining everything through evolutionary biology and neuroscience, and those two fields can be combined to explain almost anything, right? To many modern people who share this sort of materialistic or naturalistic view of the world. So you could say the longing for adventure and the longing for home could each be explained as having some survival advantage for our distant ancestors. And over millions of years of evolution, those things became hardwired into our brains. And so it has a foundation in neuroscience now, but a foundation that was laid through evolutionary biology. Perhaps the desire to set out and explore would have been a benefit to our ancestors. You can imagine how that could be. Discovering new food sources and places to live and all the things that we would have needed to survive. The hunger for home, the longing to come back and be around familiar things, certainly could have had a reproductive advantage as well, for social cohesion, survival, and safety in a group. So there's a million ways in which people who don't believe in God at all but believe that we can explain everything in terms of scientific categories, there's plenty of ways in which one could set out to explain these things. But if this is the only explanation for what we see in ourselves now, it does, we have to be honest, completely undermine the validity of any of our deepest desires. It sort of labels them a residual effect of our prehistoric needs, right, that happen to still be lingering with us, right? If we were honest, we would have to admit that the longings that feel most important to most of us most of the time have no real meaning for us now. They're the equivalent of an appendix that you can have removed or not. You know, you can have it removed and you're still a person. One would say that to hang our hopes on there being anything real out there to which our longings correspond is just naive wish fulfillment. And this is a strong criticism. I don't want to be guilty of wish fulfillment. I don't want my faith to be a result of just really, really, really wanting something nice to be true. Right? I don't think any of us should want that. We want to believe what the Bible teaches us because we're confident that it's true. It also happens to be good news, right? But just because it's good news doesn't make it untrue. and doesn't make faith simply wish fulfillment necessarily. So it seems to me that everything depends on whether we were intentionally made, whether we have a purpose because we were made or not. The creation is so central to this whole conversation. If we were made by God, then there's nothing strange about our thirst for astonishment and safety. The doctrine of creation validates and gives meaning to these two longings. They were placed in us for a purpose, and they correspond to God's own character. If there is no creation and no intention behind our existence, then these very same human desires become something ultimately to dismiss or to condescend to. I'm gonna end by reading a paragraph out of an essay by C.S. Lewis. It's actually an address or a sermon called The Weight of Glory, and it's very well known, so many of you may have read it already. But he's getting at something that is one approach to this idea of an apologetic of longing, when we're trying to find a contact point with people that do not share the Christian faith. but do share many of the same longings, you know, that were placed in them by the God who made them in his image. So this is just a paragraph out of the Weight of Glory, and then I will end, and then we can have a discussion. But this is C.S. Lewis. Do what they will, then, we remain conscious of a desire which no natural happiness will satisfy. But is there any reason to suppose that reality offers any satisfaction to it? And then it's in quotes here, nor does the being hungry prove that we have bread, end quote. But I think it may be urged that this misses the point. A man's physical hunger does not prove that that man will get any bread. He may die of starvation on a raft in the Atlantic. But surely a man's hunger does prove that he comes of a race which repairs its body by eating and inhabits a world where edible substances exist. In the same way, though I do not believe, I wish I did, that my desire for paradise proves that I shall enjoy it, I think it is a pretty good indication that such a thing exists and that some men will. A man may love a woman and not win her, but it would be very odd if the phenomenon called falling in love occurred in a sexless world. Here, then, is the desire still wandering and uncertain of its object and still largely unable to see that object in the direction where it really lies. This is, I think this describes many, many people in the world today, still wandering and uncertain of its object and still largely unable to see that object in the direction where it really lies. That's where I want to end. Thank you for listening. And at LaBrie, we throw it open for discussion or questions, pushback if necessary. But anybody who needs to leave now can feel free to leave without hurting anybody's feelings. But anybody who wants to talk can. So, anybody? Yeah.
That quote that you read, probably the same thing, but I think it's known as C.S. Lewis's argument from desire.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how there's a longing for things, and these longings in many ways prove that these things exist. So an infant can long for milk, and that's because there's such a thing as milk, and a duck can long to swim in water, and that's because there's such a thing as water. But there's this desire, this longing, this deep longing that we all have that just can't be satisfied. His conclusion is that it's because we're made for another world.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And he develops that idea in different ways, in different places. I mean, certainly in Surprised by Joy, he talks about that sort of at length, where he calls it joy, but it's really something resembling pain. This sort of unmet longing for something that doesn't know what it is yet, but it's this desire to make contact with something that he can't ever quite make contact with, and he seeks to manufacture that feeling by going to all the books and the literature that has produced it for him. And he finds that it slips through your fingers. The second you see it and grab it, it's gone. And his explanation is, well, it was never in those things in the first place. It's through those things that essentially heaven is calling to him. And so he, after becoming a Christian, he sort of learns to, in retrospect, interpret his desires all along, which is interesting.
Where was your last quote from?
It's from a sermon called The Weight of Glory. And you can find it usually in compilation of essays by Lewis.
Okay.
And it's all about desire. And the growth in desire that we need to actually long for God. There's this wonderful quote here where it says, I'm not going to read the whole Weight of Glory. Indeed, if we can, so he's trying to say that if in your Christian circles you've been told that desire is a bad thing, is something we're supposed to suppress and ignore, that this has crept in from Kant and not from the Bible. And then he says, indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. He's saying we're supposed to desire God, but we're not strong enough to do it yet. We don't have the fortitude to actually long for something as big and real as God. So we'd rather like mess around in the mud, you know. Yeah. Yeah, Tom.
I would use his little pushback. I would use your own talk to push back on Augustine's quote.
Oh, okay.
Because Augustine said you're restless and you finally find rest.
Mm-hmm.
The two aren't coexisting in that quote, the way I hear it.
In
Augustine's quote, he said we're restless until we find our rest in you, instead of continuing to find adventure in him.
Oh yeah, well I mean
maybe he didn't mean it that way.
Yeah,
but I think on the surface it sounds like I'm finally home and that's the end of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't think I doubt that he would say that.
On the surface, it sounds that way.
Yeah.
In fact, that quote, "Eternity in your hearts."
Yeah.
The New American Standard. After he says he has also said eternity in your hearts. Before the sentence is over, he says, "Yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end," suggesting continual adventure,
mm-hmm. or continual growth in knowledge of God. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, which I hope is an adventure.
Yeah, yeah. And my hunch is that Augustine would not say that it's some sort of static rest that we come to. We're all done. In the progression of the confessions, it's this picture of a tormented person that's always, he's sort of driven by his desires and always disappointed by what he's chasing after. And you get the sense that God is sort of driving him from behind with his disillusionment, but also drawing him forward with longing for what is good. And so, yeah, anyway, again, that's just the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. Chris, did you have something?
Yeah, I was interested in your fishing story.
Good!
Well, you know, to me, fishing seems boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Christianity can seem boring as well. Why would you want to sit on a still lake that had your line of the water when there might not be any fish down there anyway?
Mm.
When down there out here, we've got rapids.
Mm-hmm.
And there's rapids all around us. And they're noisy and they're exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no fish. You know, and you get done and you're, but what has happened in you, you know, what have you got to take for dinner? There's no,
right. The
adrenaline.
Yeah, you know? A good memory, some good memories.
I'm a whitewater kayaker, and I would say life is more than food.
But you have to eat something when you get home again.
But my point is that the culture is just bombarding us with things that are... With the water stirring, saying there's fish here, but there's no fish there, there's just the water making the noise.
Yeah.
And to have the quietness and to be willing to be quiet and to be willing to take the time, because it is not the case that, you know, you're always going to land a giant catfish.
That is true.
It's slow, it is, you go through times when it's unrewarding you. And to tell people that, you know, doesn't sound like a great sales pitch.
Right. It doesn't blend in with the kind of distractions that are being offered people, which are just like you said. I mean, the sort of froth on the water with nothing real. Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah. I mean, to follow every metaphor falls apart eventually, but the notion of being quiet and sitting still and being okay with nothing happening for a long time is, I mean, there's no guarantee in the Bible that we are just gonna, find the Lord by just not caring too much about finding him. seek me with all your strength and with all your mind while I may be found, you know.
Yeah, well, and so you have Augustine taking an incredibly long time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think something that I didn't really talk about too much is it, when it comes to speaking to people who just don't buy it, don't believe any of this stuff. I have a good friend that falls into this category. He's such a good person, and in some ways is content with his life and what he's done, and he hasn't reached this sort of disillusionment or discontent with following his desires. He just, you know, and so it's hard to know exactly what to say exactly. You know, you want to, it's not that I wish hardship on him, but all I'm saying is that when we speak to somebody, it's a cliche, but they're on a journey, and may or may not be aware that the things they're pursuing in life are a dead end. But I think there's a lot in our culture to keep us distracted and not thinking about actual meaning and actual significance. Anybody? Liz?
Yeah, it's interesting because I had a friend who's very similar to that. And like, she's an atheist. She's very complacent in her life in a lot of ways. But she really loves nature, and she keeps coming to me with these experiences that she has of this kind of longing that she finds in nature, and she'll ask me, like, where does this come from? Like,
yeah.
What do I do about this? And kind of, you know, like,
yeah.
making some small cuts on the path.
Yeah.
But,
that's the question we want everyone to ask, right?
Yeah,
I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah, years and years.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
But she sees something there that just like excites her worldview, even though like nature is,
yeah,
it is like concrete and seems like easily explained.
But yeah.
Worldview, like there's something which she hasn't talked about that kind of thing for some right place, but
yeah,
that she can't get rid of.
Like, this is one of the reasons why neo-paganism is so attractive and appealing. I knew somebody. A very committed Christian who said, if I wasn't a Christian, I'd be a neo-pagan, definitely. Just because it gives you some sense that there's some spiritual significance to all the beauty that we see around us in the natural world.
Yeah.
And it's like, I would need something to explain it in a deeper way than just material, you know? Anyway, yeah. Yeah. Did you want to continue, or do you have more to say?
Yeah, just that, I mean, she keeps telling me, like, she doesn't... It doesn't matter to have meaning in life, and that, and you know, her, like, she's like generations of weirdness in her family, mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, she's interested in that concept, okay. Seemingly over. You know?
Yeah.
But she doesn't recognize it herself, though.
Yeah. And it's very sad. I mean, it's a very sad thing. We should be sad about this because it's sort of a terrible thing to dismiss. Or to have a worldview that forces you to dismiss on some level something that is so good, right?
Yeah, she has that explanation.
I have to explain it away somehow as being only...
Yeah,
yeah,
something
yeah.
about trees, like how trees make us feel good inside, like studies, like through...
Must be all the oxygen they're producing that we're breathing
yeah,
in.
Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. May have something to do with it, you know, but it's I guess it's reductionism. It's reducing everything down to, you know... To just one explanation. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
So you touched on dominion,
mm-hmm.
And how we were created to have dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And it really struck a chord with me. I might be reaching here, but we just got back from visiting my family,
mm-hmm.
And I think. You know, just like most people, I come from a lovely dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the dysfunction can be chalked up to like issues of dominion.
Yeah.
My sister has a disability, and no one has enslaved her. Like,
mm-hmm.
But she's sort of enslaved by it
yeah.
in a way. And my father is you know, a retired, non-working man, and he's, you know, I think it's miserable for him.
Yeah.
To not have dominion. So anyways, I can go on and on with everybody. Everyone's got an issue with it. But, so I've never really thought about that before. I've honestly never thought about how that is something that we're all created to have, and that when it's taken away from us, something's just not right.
Yeah.
And I thought about how there isn't always like an easy fix for it. Mm-hmm. Not that slavery is an easy fix, but you could point to like an earthly way to fix it. You know, like bringing justice to the people who are enslaved. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things that cannot be resolved by like earthly means.
Yeah.
Something that you will die with. Like as a
person with a disability.
A disability, yeah. An incurable one at least.
Yep.
And how, and also my family, half of them are like unbelievers. You know, what could I say? Or like, you know, if you could shed some more light on that issue. Mm. Like what is the hope like in Christ that could give that type of person who will not reconcile this in this world, like having a relationship with Jesus, like how does that give you back your dominion that you're longing for?
Yeah, that was a very good question. On one level, you sort of have to say that belonging to Christ isn't going to give you back all your dominion now, because we're not, when we turn to Christ and give ourselves to Him, we're still living with the effects of the fall, and there's ways in which, like you said, people rob other people of dominion, and there's other ways in which our dominion is squashed, and no one in particular has done it to us. But just every bit as much of an effect of the fall as slavery is. There may be ways in which, or there are ways in which all of us never realize our full sort of creational intended dominion, you know, now. There won't be. Really what the Christian faith does is offer us a promise of being a new creation. You think of what causes the loss of dominion in the first place is rebelling against God, and this sin becomes this barrier, and then all these good things and good capacities that God has given us are out of whack and are twisted, and the relationship between people, which is supposed to be loving and harmonious, is now suddenly manipulative and oppressive in different ways. And first and foremost, sin has to be dealt with. So I mean, there's no way toward reaching this sort of human wholeness that we're longing for without the cross, which is both dealing with the guilt of our sin, but also sort of taking on the brokenness of the whole world. And I think for someone who is struggling with a physical disability, there's the doctrine of the resurrection, which is some churches talk about it more than others, but it's every bit as central to the Christian faith as the cross. That Jesus Christ, his resurrection, is what guarantees our future resurrection, but it's also a picture for us of our future resurrection, which is fully restored bodies that will not die. So there's a very physical promise of the final resurrection that is something much more than dying and going to be with the Lord in a disembodied sort of state. It's part and parcel of a whole new creation, and so that's the hope, I think, when the Bible talks about the new heaven and the new earth and the final resurrection. This is, but it's a far off hope, and I think there's a lot in terms of what the Christian faith is right now as a resource before these promises are fulfilled. It gives us a sort of framework to understand that what is wrong with us is actually wrong. It's not just, oh, you know, some people have disabilities and that's just their thing. And that's, you know, there's a lot of talk in circles dealing with disability. There's been a shift away from something that was happening a number of years ago, which is basically just that, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right. Maybe Joshua, you can help me with this. Stephanie, she wrote a book called "Same Lake, Different Boat." It's about disabilities. There's a woman who has a son who's has Down syndrome, and a number of years ago, it was very sort of politically correct to talk about disabilities as being just a normal part of a normal world, you know. And she's saying, no, this is not the biblical view of it is that it's a normal part of an abnormal world. The world is broken because of the fall. It's full of this kind of misery everywhere we look. But because this kind of brokenness is everywhere, disabilities are normal. Not normal in the sense of God's intention at creation, but normal as in everywhere we look. And so it's not because disabilities are normal and good. It's because the world is broken and we're in the world. And so, it's the doctrine of creation and fall gives us this amazing sort of foundation for understanding why a lot of the things we look at are a result of something having gone wrong. And actually are not how God intended them to be. So there's, sorry, I've caught on for a long time, but in all of this, it really depends on the person you're talking to and what you think, how well you know them and whether you think, what you think they will understand and but I think the reality of the fall is something that we just have to be honest about and that, you know, belonging to Christ doesn't make us immune from these kinds of things. I don't know. Any thoughts on that? Yeah. Please.
Well, but isn't a lot of the adventure really the sort of wanting to explore and discover one's own full humanity? And that the dominion is in part over the world, but the real promise, I think, for now is growth in dominion over ourselves. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that's something that can continue on. I mean, we're retired, you know, so we're not in this position of sort of changing the world, but we can still allow God to change us. Mm-hmm. And so that coming to... I remember seeing a documentary on prisons, and they had these interviews with these various prisoners, and every one of them said, well, I had to do what I did. Mm. You know, and that slavery is sin.
Yeah.
And so the discovery that you don't have to, that is the dominion that you can slowly begin to live into, mm-hmm. of not having to do the sins that have plagued you your whole life.
Yeah.
For however much of it you've lived.
Yeah.
And that's true regardless of your personal circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And we become... more and more ourselves as we do that. Because our sin is one of the ways in which we essentially our idolatries, which are, you know, seeking after substitutes for God that we can control more easily. And we actually, it's not only an insult to God, we're denigrating ourselves when we do that because we ourselves are images of God who were made to worship Him and nothing else. So we become something less than what we're supposed to be.
And we do that sometimes when we're trying to make ourselves God, too. That denigrates us as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Jane.
I was reflecting back in a book. I'm thinking it's John Eldridge, mm-hmm. Sacred Journey, I don't know. But somehow the pull between, you know, home and belonging, mm-hmm. the journey. One chapter, he talks really extensively about how the pull between being a pilgrim and then sojourning and being a sojourner. And, and he quotes like Robinson Crusoe, just kind of hunkered down versus like Bilbo Baggins, you know, the journey, the road.
Yeah.
But just that, the contrast.
I mean, it's what finding our home in God means in terms of our relationship to this world now. It's interesting. We're the citizens of heaven, you know, and yet, does that mean that the world around us is of no value or useless or something like that? Sometimes the way people talk about being a pilgrim, this world is just, you know, can't wait to get through it. Which, you know, depending on people's life experience, it may be more understandable. But it's true that this world as it is right now is not our home. You know, the promise. In Revelation and in Isaiah of this new heaven and new earth is this sort of it's a transformation and a recreation of the world that will not with no effects of the fall there anymore but is there anything else you wanted to say about that? I haven't read that book, so
I found this discussion to be surprisingly relevant this past year since I was at university. This whole dichotomy of longing seems to be very prevalent among college students, I think for obvious reasons. What also became interesting to me, though, was that several of my friends, noticeably artists and philosophy majors, seem to enjoy discussing the longing as much as searching for fulfillment, in a way tangling with this struggle and this yearning itself became a kind of fulfillment, almost as if they were more in love with the road itself than either Gondor or the Shire, and they just kind of loved wrestling into that tension, but staying there.
Yeah.
So how do you reawaken desire for fulfillment in someone like that? Yeah. How would you encourage them to set out again on the road that they're currently sitting on and say, this interest to grapple with longing is itself a warped kind of fulfillment of what that longing is supposed to be?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. It's all about the journey. The destination doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It's just the struggle. It's the struggle.
Right.
And just living the struggle and this idea that there's any destination at all is just so...
Which so easily slides into kind of new age mysticism.
Yeah, well, because when we start talking about destinations, it starts to sound exclusive, right? I mean, nobody wants to talk about that, but the struggle is more of a sort of a universal human thing. Yeah, that's a good question. I so often I don't know, the challenge is to not be predictable in the things we say. To me, what that sounds like, your description of that, just sort of reveling in the sort of angst of the longing, but you know, it doesn't matter what's out there if it corresponds to anything, but it's just the experience of sort of unmet desire. I'm just going to sort of stroke that, you know. That's sentimentality.
It's also college.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. Yeah. I was totally like that. Probably describes me pretty well. Yeah. I've got something more to say, but do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about what you were saying, how these two different longings. Still kind of see where you started the lecture of them being kind of like at odds with each other, and thinking about some something I was reading when I first got here, which was talking about stages of life. How in the first stage of life we're sort of set out to find ourselves or have an adventure or whatever, whatever you want to call it, and then the second stage of life being kind of where you want to just kind of come home. And this idea that, you know, you do this journey and you get to the end and you realize it's the beginning where you started all along.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think practically speaking, these longings are different in different times of life and are sort of more appropriate at certain other, you know, it may be more appropriate to have for one of those to be more powerful in our lives than another. I guess the Chesterton's point being that the ultimate fulfillment of both of those longings is met in, he says, the creed. You know, he's a very, yeah. But I think that to me doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the what you're talking about, sort of times of life, chapters in life, where it's more appropriate to drift towards one than the other. I mean, if everybody was like your description of the college student their whole life, it'd be quite a, I mean, some people are, you know, but it'd be unusual and not good. Before we move on too far, I just want to say what makes that sound like sentimentality to me is the idea that we get attached to an emotional experience and experiencing that emotion over and over again, rather than connecting with anything real outside our own heads. So, you know, for instance, if I'm being sentimental, I could watch a movie and with cute kids doing something really nice or something, and I'd be like, "Oh, this is so beautiful." And it may be beautiful. It may be something really good, you know. But I get attached to my own emotional response to that, and I want to feel that again. And or even most of us are probably guilty on some level of sentimentality about really terrible things. I watch the news and see some miserable event and other people suffering. I'm like, oh, it's agony. You know, I may even cry, and then I may really like that experience of being so moved by someone else's suffering because it makes me feel good about myself. It makes me think of myself as a really caring person who's moved by other people's pain. So I sort of want to experience that again and then again. And it becomes reenacting an emotional experience. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything outside my own head. Has nothing to do with helping anybody. Has nothing to do with, you know, and so a lot of habitual anger for me is sentimental. We don't often think of anger as sentimental. We think of it as like, you know, I don't know, raw but if I enjoy the sensation of feeling righteously indignant about some stupid thing that someone has done, and I'll think about that whenever I can, so I feel righteously indignant. Again, it's just me stroking my own kind of little thing. It has nothing to do with anything outside. And so those kinds of things are pretty unattractive, but what you're describing is pretty much the same thing. Right.
Yeah. So what would you encourage them to like read or do or foster that would pass sentimentality?
It's like I'm
not sure how to answer that, but yeah.
I mean, I'll just throw into the mix is that I would say that part of everything you're describing is a way of trying to feel alive. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's true life. You know, C.S. Lewis was talking about you didn't desire enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think I don't particularly. I heard Bruce Springsteen, who I don't know much about, but I heard him say once, when I go to a show, what I'm trying to give people is I want them to feel more alive. That's what I'm delivering. That's where they come to. And that's nice on his part,
Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit sad that we have to pay money and jam ourselves into a stadium to feel alive. That's possibly another angle.
Yeah.
That people are trying to feel alive, so I don't know where you might take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Is that whole... Well, who knows? It so depends on the person. I mean, some people may be really working through stuff that's important to work through, and it takes a long time. The question of is this actually life giving? Someone in college might not be at a point to recognize it. I don't know. It depends so much on who you're talking to and what they're. With their experiences.
I mean, connect to that. I think of it, I mean, I agree with Adam to a certain extent, it's college. but without being super cynical about that, part of the reason it's college is because of people who are traditional college students, like 18 to 22, it's this in-between space where you have set out a little bit, you have left mm-hmm. home in some way, shape, or form. You are exhibiting dominion in a new way, mm-hmm. not a full way. You're not mm-hmm. maybe full, some people are, but you're maybe not fully independent. You're not mm-hmm. paying all your bills and paying rent and buying all, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a step towards that, but you're not all the way there yet. Mm-hmm. And so some of that is just, I think, a developmental stage in mm-hmm. some ways. But I think, kind of like Tom said, I think of it as being like, almost a self-stimulating behavior
mm-hmm.
Because I'm just thinking of the picture Ben showed earlier of the thrill seeker with like the guy doing the handstand on the ledge and thing, right? Like when you think of like that sense of like the adventure or whatever, and it's like the rush, right? It's the wonder and the feel and the excitement and the rush. And there's a way, and I think about this with some students we've had at Libri before who just spin in their own muck, and we can call it drama, we can call it whatever. And it's almost like they're self-stimulating because there's too much fear, or they don't feel equipped, mm. or they don't feel like they have the resources to actually take the real step. So mm-hmm. you can spend all this time talking about this boy you have a crush on, and does he like you, and did he look at you, and what did that mean, and da-da-da-da, but not actually engage with the boy. Mm-hmm. Who would say yes or say no, and then you move on with your life.
Who right? will be definitely a disappointment when you talk to him.
Right. So there's the fear that maybe in real life it won't happen and then you have nothing, or the fear that it will, but I'm not actually ready for that, or I'm scared of that, or mm-hmm. whatever. So there's a way, I think, that some of the what you're talking about is... Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it's almost like a fear of fulfillment in itself.
Yeah, and it may like not be fear. It may not be consciously fear, but I think like you're trying to touch that feeling, that that sort of sensory internal experience, without taking the risk, without taking the chance, without, you know, if you're an artist, it's a huge risk to put your art out in front of people, right? And so you can like have the drama and the energy and the whatever, the angsty artist, without having to take a risk of like being vulnerable in front of people.
Yeah, and also, I mean, in the context of art making, there's a huge, depending on what circles you're in, there's a huge sort of stigma against coming out and saying anything passionately at all. You know, it is much safer to ask questions, to have something be a product of wrestling with something, but not actually have a, and sometimes that's a good thing, because sometimes, you know, Christians particularly are guilty of their art being just way too obvious and no room for any ambiguity or any room for anybody to really engage. But at the same time, it's a risky thing to mean something. It's much cooler to be ironic and not mean anything. And so I don't know. There's a ways of avoiding me appearing to mean anything at all. But anyway, yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I'm just gonna add one last thing to that conversation, is that I think that again, talking about the traditional college student, like not, very young. I think a lot of it is lack of life experience. Again, mm-hmm. that doesn't speak to everyone, because a lot of people have had a ton of life experience by the time they turn 18.
But it's so easy to not take a stance on anything. I used to be, like, so unbiased. And, you know, I don't feel qualified to have an opinion on this or that or anything in the world. Because I really did. I wasn't qualified enough for anything. And I think that it's just can sometimes be pretty honest. Like, you haven't completely set out yet. And there haven't been enough things maybe for that specific person that have impacted him or her in a way that it is like, no, I definitely like don't want to go here, or I definitely need to go there, or you know, like over time things shape you and impact you beyond undoing it. You know, until we, you know, end up in heaven, like there's no undoing certain things. Sometimes they're terrible things, but yeah, I just wanted to add
that.
Sometimes I think it's experience.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom.
I'd be curious what you think about your talk, particularly capped off with that C.S. Lewis quote about desire, didn't desire enough, and how that fits in with what I personally, I'll tip my hand here, what I personally consider is Christian psychobabble, to say something like, "Die, you need to die to self, you know, death to self, die to self," which actually gets a lot of serious discussion. But to me it seems absolutely opposed to this strong desire.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think what Lewis is describing as our weak desires, the state of the child playing with mud in the slums. He says in many other places that, you know, you have to die to yourself to actually get to the place where you can see God, which is actually to be fully yourself. Finally, so dying to self is dying to not the intended self by God that we will one day be. It's dying to our broken, sinful self, what Paul calls the flesh. You know, being willing to put to death that sort of ambitious, grasping self, which, if we believe in the atonement, we believe that that self actually died with Christ.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And now
dying to self is all about living into the reality that's.
Well, that's where I would take the. Yeah. I would take Romans where it says, "Those who by the Spirit are putting to death the deeds of the flesh." It's no longer. The reason I think that phrase is problematic is because
dying to self.
Dying to self is because of what you pointed out. First off, if we believe the atonement, it has happened. And the other reason it's problematic is because, particularly coming out of Hindu, the drug culture of the 60s and 70s had a lot of influence from the Hindu. Hinduism, where nirvana was desirelessness. Literally, go to a guru, eat dung and eat honey, and don't care which it was. And that was a type of dying to self. I mean, self is your innermost being, and that innermost being is being saved.
Yeah.
It's not
negating of the individual. Well, I don't think that that's what the New Testament means when it talks about dying to self.
It doesn't talk about that. That's the funny thing.
I think
that actual phrase is very hard to find.
Where does
the seed has to die?
Yeah.
The
doesn't Paul talk about dying to
self? He says he dies daily.
He does. Yeah.
But he often says the old man.
But what he's getting at is. Which is kind of a pattern in quite a few of his letters. He's laying down a theology of what Christ has made you. You have the old self has died with Christ. The new has risen with him. So there's a theological reality right now about you. But yet you're still a sinner, and there's still a lot in you that needs to die daily. What he's talking about is the struggle of sanctification, which is living into and trying to be who Christ says you are. So God sees, you know, if I belong to Christ, God sees me as having the righteousness of Christ now. Does that mean I'm not a sinner? No, it means that I'm supposed to with all of my strength, act like who I am. And one day I'll be made whole again. And so it's not, and Lewis is really good on this, actually, that you become, when you die to yourself, you finally become, yeah, become more yourself. So it's not negating the individual in a way that, maybe Zen Buddhism is, you know, if you've approached a certain level of enlightenment, you experience no distinctions between anything and anything else, including yourself. Well, and that's not at all a New Testament idea.
Well, perhaps it's mm-hmm. partly vocabulary, but this is the reason it's a personal thing for me, because mm-hmm. of a particular, as a new believer, I was under the influence of people,
yeah,
supposedly Orthodox,
yeah,
who basically caused me not to hear God's voice for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said, if you have any thought and it's pleasurable to you, that can't be from God.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's just deeply wrong. Yeah.
No, well, that was how they interpreted die to self.
Yeah.
If anything was pleasurable, that was yourself. Yeah.
So anything from God must be miserable to you. Otherwise, right. Yeah, which
otherwise
is just, it's just pathetic. That's pathetic. Yeah.
Right. So I think some of it is.
Did they keep you from reading the Bible?
No. Well, and that's why I searched the Bible carefully, looking for that phrase, the literal phrase, die to self.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. Anyway, I don't want to take this off.
Well, I mean, Lewis is very. I mean, have you read The Weight of Glory? It's a good one to read.
It sounds interesting.
He starts out the whole thing. I'll just read the beginning of this, and then we'll end. If you ask 20 good men today what they thought the highest of virtues, 19 of them would reply unselfishness. But if you ask almost any of the great Christians of old, he would have replied love. You see what has happened? A negative term has been substituted for a positive. The negative ideal of unselfishness carries with it the suggestion not primarily of securing good things for others, but of going without them ourselves. As if our abstinence and not their happiness was the important point. I do not think this is the Christian virtue of love. The New Testament has lots to say about self-denial, but not about self-denial as an end in itself. So it's... The end result is joy and finally becoming who you're intended to be, but that may require some self-denial. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, when Jesus says, pick up your cross and follow me, he didn't say pick up your cross because it's just great to carry crosses, and you know God is happy if you're miserable. It's you, in order to follow me, which is the way to life, you will need to pick up that cross.
Fair enough.
And so, But there's a lot. I think a lot of people have similar experiences of just, you know, if you want to do something and it gives you joy, you can be sure that God is unhappy about that, and that's just really sad.
It is really sad.
Yeah,
but
pathetic.
Some of it comes down to what is that self we're talking about?
Yeah.
Is it the new creation which after Christ has been given righteousness and holiness of truth?
Yeah.
Is that what we're dying to? Mm-hmm. The new or just what is it? And for a new believer, it can be confusing.
Yeah.
And when people then start, it can be confusing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It can be. There's a lot of things to misunderstand. I'm going to end. But thank you, everybody. I appreciate you sticking around.
Temptation to get into virtual reality and all that.
Okay.
It's too cheap and too easy to say a lot of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I'm probably guilty of that myself. But
but it is the central problem. There is no fit.
It's like
right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's the simplest way to put it is, we'll give you the ripple, we'll give you anything you want.
In a sense, it's very consistent with a... with a very rigid, reductionistic neuroscience that, you know, I can't even be sure that there's anything really out there. All that I experience in my consciousness is just a result of you know, the firing of neurons in my brain. So what's the difference if there's a real person or not? If I'm experiencing something in my brain, who cares?
Yeah, I know. That's another part of it. I don't want to go in there,
okay.
There either, because I've done both neuroscience.
Yeah, well, you know a lot more than I do.
Stuff.
Yeah.
And everything you said is absolutely right. Okay. But it is so tangled that it's very hard to make any sensible statement about it without like hours long discussion to get together with exactly where you're both sitting. And then you say something.
You know, I was conscious that in my very short little section, I was just sort of lobbing something out there that really requires more,
it's a big
more focused
deal.
Attention.
It's a big
but
deal.
Yeah, it is.
And when I read the title,
what I feel like saying, which is not getting at anything terribly useful, is what difference does it make if all this is going on in your head? All that evolution has happened. So what? Is that explaining anything about the world? No.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's a fun theoretical.
Thank you, Ben.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming
to play with.
Yeah.
And it has explanatory power for some things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe even lots of things. But fundamentally, so what?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the issue.
Yeah. In terms of what. This is something that my dad was talking about last week. It's just sort of the way in which a lot of reductionist ways of thinking. He was talking about various different intellectuals from Boston, actually. Stephen Pinker, Stephen Jay Gould, and various other people.
There's plenty of them.
But have a completely naturalistic view, no belief in anything supernatural, transcendent, and yet kind of cheat despite their actual philosophy, sort of projecting meaning onto this sort of upper story that they have no foundation for having at all. And I remember reading somewhere. It was under Bill Clinton that they finally finished mapping the human genome. Like there was somewhere around there. Yeah,
they by the way never finally finished.
Oh, they didn't. Okay,
but they had one version of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, so what? We all differ.
Right.
Tens of thousands.
Right.
DNA bases.
Yeah.
Each other.
And organisms that are radically different from each other, when you look at them, are remarkably similar genetically.
Right.
So, well, yeah. What are we explaining?
Well, we don't even know why that is.
The quote that I was thinking about was, you know, we are somewhere close to mapping the human genome, then we'll understand who we are.
Yeah, right.
But it was just such a ridiculously naive thing. Like, you really?
That's
you can only do that by reducing a human being to something so completely insignificant. That you
I am participant isn't the right term anymore. Very early on, I was in this. Discussion group, whatever. Evo Devo Universe is the name of it. That doesn't really make much difference. The point is, it's loaded with neuroscience.